Good afternoon, everybody. Good evening, everybody. Shmuel Plotzer coming at you live from Gulf Manor Synagogue, our School of Jewish Studies. It's Tuesday night. I think it's June 4th. I'm losing track of time and space. We're getting ready for Shabbos and Shavuos. And Baruch Hashem, I give a Sunday morning shiur, which could not be avoided. I give a Monday afternoon shiur. Sunday morning is, of course, Midrash, intro to Midrash. We've already seen some Midrashim of Shir HaShirim in anticipation of Pesach. The past few weeks, we've been doing intro Midrash to Rus, Midrash Rus. We saw a good chunk, now obviously there's a tremendous amount, but we did take a little bite out of Midrash Rus. And then tonight, Malachim Aleph, First Kings. So I'm very blessed to be able to give these classes. All the while, we're trying to prepare a special hour and a half shiur for Shavuos, Tikkun Lo Shavuos, at 4 o'clock in the morning, and the name of the class will be Who Wrote the Tanakh? An exploration of Baba Basra, 14b to 16a, where the Chazal will tell us who wrote what Sfarim, why they wrote it. It's just fascinating. So if you get a chance, take a look at those Dapim of Gemara and Baba Basra, 14b to 16a. And then also we're going to do an overview of the thought of Rav Kook on Israel. Kind of like, if you haven't been going to the classes over the past several weeks, then by all means come to our, maybe it'll be a pre-mincha class for about an hour, and you'll learn everything you need to know. It's kind of going to be a distillation of all the hottest topics and hottest thoughts that Rav Kook has about the land of Israel and the importance of the land of Israel. That's going to be about an hour or so before Mincha, maybe on the, first or second day. It all depends on stuff. So all this stuff takes time. Got to photocopy everything. Got to look it over. Got to have what to say. But tonight we're doing First Kings. Let's get right to it. First Kings, Malachim Aleph, chapter 10. We've just completed the Queen of Sheba. She was prominent in the very first 13 verses or so of 1 Kings chapter 10, and now we're going to continue. We're done with her. Obviously, we shouldn't forget her. She made it into Scripture, and there's what to learn, but we've already touched upon it, and now we move on. And so we're in 1 Kings chapter 10, verse 14. Verse 14, Pasuk Yedaled, Vahi Mishkal Hazav, Asher Ba Lishlomo B'Shana Achas. So the weight of gold which came to Solomon in 1 year, Sheish Meos Shishim Vashesh Kikar Zav, 666 talents of gold. 666 talents of gold. It's a lot of gold. It's an interesting number. In the Western consciousness, that's a bad number. In the Jewish consciousness, it doesn't mean anything at all. In the West, it does. By us Yidden, it doesn't. But you know what? Who cares about that? At all events, it's an unusual number to come up with. Funny how this precise number comes up over here, and it's a bad number for the Christians and for the Yidden. It doesn't matter at all. Numbers don't have any bad significance one way or the other. So the weight of gold which came to Solomon in 1 year was 666 talents of gold. Take a look at the footnote. So verse 14. 666. Rashi is going to be distilled into English over here. Let's read it. Hiram gave him 120 talents of gold. And we saw that already. Actually, according to verse 14, that is our verse. And I'm sure that we've got a better verse than 14 because we have to. If I find it, I'll let you know. At all events, Hiram gave him gold. All right. And the queen of Sheba gave him 120. And the ships of Tarshish brought from Ophir 420. So you have 120 and 120, and of course that's 240. Add that to 420, you get 660. Says Rashi, I don't know from where the other six came, because you've got 666, says Rashi. So knew where the other six come from. He doesn't know. In 2 Chronicles chapter 8, verse 18, it states that the ships brought from Ophir 450 talents. However, it does not include the 120 talents of Hiram. All right? So according to 2 Chronicles, the ships of Tarshish brought from Ophir 450. And according to our verses over here, 420. So we have a 30 talent discrepancy between the two sources. All right, we can resolve the contradictions by saying, says Rashi, that the extra 30, which are mentioned in 2 Chronicles were from the 120 of Hiram. Well, I guess you could always do that. You could always, you know, dip into the bank account of Hiram. If he's giving you 120, then you can account for the missing 30. I guess you could do that. Okay, we can resolve the contradiction by saying that the extra 30 were from the 120 of Hiram, because Hiram's servants were in Ophir with Shlomo's servants. All that is Rashi. Abarbanel explains that the Queen of Sheba was prompted to visit Shlomo through her encounter with his ships, which he had sent to her land. So as soon as she saw these big boats, she says, "Well, I gotta go meet this man." After her successful visit, she used her influence to acquire huge amounts of gold as tribute to King Solomon. Therefore, the ships brought back from Ophir 666 talents of gold. And this is the footnote in here in the Judaica Press. It continues a little bit more. This is a continuation of the account of Shlomo's wealth. It was interrupted by the episode of the Queen of Sheba and resumed immediately after it. Okay, we continue on. We're on verse 15. Aside from that which came through merchants and the commerce of spice peddlers, again, Levi outside, he got all this gold. In verse 14, he got a tremendous amount of gold, 666 talents of gold, besides the gold that he got from Levi Me'anshe HaTarim, except for, I mean, aside from the stuff he's going to get from merchants, Umischar HaRuchlim, and the transactions, the commerce of spice peddlers. And they also gave him gold. B'chol Malchei HaErev, and all the dependent kings. That won't be the only translation, but it is one of them. And all the kings who are dependent on him and are subservient to Shlomo, Ufachos HaAretz, and the regents of the land. So he was getting tribute from them too. This man was getting, he had cash flow, you might say. He had a lot of cash flow going on. So, King Shlomo, pretty impressive. Take a look. This is verse 15 in the footnote. Levad me'anshi hatarim. He got all that gold in verse 14 besides anything he's going to get from the merchants, okay? Literally, aside from the merchants, says Rashi. Rashi paraphrases that the merchants who traversed the land on business would bring to him. Rashi had said in Hebrew, "Shehayu meviim lo hasochrim hatarim ba'aris l'schorim." The men, sochrim, merchants, would bring to him commerce, spice peddlers, anshei hatarim is actually merchants, okay? So Rashi's saying, shemeviim lo hasochrim hatarim ba'aretz. Okay, so the merchants would bring to him, who are these merchants? Hatarim ba'aretz, they travel around the land, l'schora, you know, to get merchandise, to sell merchandise, to get their hands on buying and selling stuff. So those people who would travel around the country, they would give him money. They gave him gold. The Radak, according to this footnote, the Radak explains Tarim as retailers who spy out the land and sell many items at a small profit. And socharim, that refers to wholesalers. Okay, so the word anshei hatarim, those are retailers. They sell many items at a small profit to people, individual people. And socharim, those are merchants of the trade, I presume. They are the wholesalers. So we have this concept even back then in ancient times of retail and wholesale. Pretty impressive. Very impressive. And this, so Shlomo got tons of gold, according to verse 14. And then verse 15 we just saw, he got all that gold in verse 14, and that was even beside all the gold that he was going to get from the merchants and the spice peddlers, and then all the what we call Malchei HaErev, dependent kings, Ufachos HaAretz, and the regions of the land. They also paid tribute. But let's see some more interpretations of what the word Tarim means, and then we're going to see what the word Malchei HaErev means. What does that mean? So we're on page 116 in your Judaica Press. We are reading the lower, on the left-hand side where the footnotes begins, it says, Ralbag explains. So we are in the middle of explaining verse 15. All right. Ralbag explains that the word tarim in our verse 15, right? Anshei ha-tarim. Ralbag says tarim as international financiers who explore possibilities to invest venture capital in many lands. All these merchants paid a tax to Shlomo. Wow. And also the spice peddlers. Rashi and Radak say those are dealers of spice who would carry them from city to city. Excuse me. And all the dependent kings. That is a translation that we have here in the main text, but it's not the only translation. The term is v'chol malchei ha'erev. In the Hebrew, v'chol malchei ha'erev. And all the dependent kings. But Targum Yonason translates v'chol malchei sumchavasa. All dependent kings, an expression of guarantee. Kings who guaranteed support and were dependent on him. And guarantee is the word in French. You see the word coming up. The something I love, garamantia. Garamantia. The word, the letter mem is coming up over there in the actual Hebrew, and you don't see that letter mem coming up when they transcribe into English. They just give you like garante. But in the Hebrew that I see in front of me, it looks like garamantia. The mem is there, and it's prominent. Garamantia. Belas. Belashim. In the French language. Okay. Mitzudas David, however, translates Malchei Erev as kings of Arabia. Now, I like that one myself a lot, because doesn't the word Malchei Erev seem to bespeak, Erev, the Arab, the Aravim, the Arabians? I mean, it does to me. But it's not the only translation out there, but I do like it. So again, the Matsuda says, Malchei Erev, kings of Arabia. The Radak says that two countries, Arav and Ha'erev, sent tribute to Shlomo. See Chronicles chapter 2. But it's probably 2 Chronicles indeed. So there are two countries which sent tribute to Shlomo. And this is based on a pasuk in Yirmiyah, chapter 25, verse 24, where Arav and Ha'erev are both mentioned. So if you've got that Jeremiah pasuk, where Arav is mentioned, Ha'erev is mentioned, and then you've got in 2 Chronicles, you've got two countries explicitly mentioned, Arav and Ha'erev. Well, you've got two scriptural sources for this, and it would lend itself to this idea that Malchei HaErev is an actual genuine country, the kings of HaErev. And that it doesn't necessarily mean, you know, guaranteeing support. It means that this is actually the country, the name of the country being Ha'erev or Erev. So I can go for that. Good. And that is verse 15. Now take a look at 16 coming up. Test dying. This is a wild one. This is like, you know, reminiscent of medieval times. Verse 10, Zion 16. Vayas HaMelech Shlomo Masayim Tzina Zahav Shachut. So King Solomon made 200 body shields. Matayim Tzina, 200 Tzina, and the word Tzina is going to mean like a shield of a sort, like a body armor, a frame of a man. I think we're going to see that. A body shield, is how they're going to translate it. Zahav shachut, malleable gold, is how they translate that. Shesh meod zahav yaleh al hatzina ha'echas. 600 dinar of gold he would put into one body shield. Wow! That's enough to stop a bullet, I would think. I mean, that's a lot, isn't it? It's a tremendous amount of stuff. And gold is heavy. We always forget that. Gold is a very heavy element. One of my rabbis, I think, in Baltimore, by Sandra Goldberg, if I'm not mistaken, we were talking about the Lubavitch understanding of the menorah and how it branches out diagonally. And that's the Rambam's take on the menorah, and that has become the Chabad take on the menorah. Even though every single menorah you've ever found in ancient antiquity, no matter whether it's real or depiction, it's always rounded. It's always, always rounded. So you ask them about that, they say, well, those are maybe the outer menorahs, but this is like an innie menorah. So it's suddenly we're talking about outies and innies, and we're talking about menorahs, and some look rounded and some are diagonal, and Lubavitch wants to insist on this. No matter how many depictions that we can dig up of ancient menorahs, it won't really matter to them, because I think Rashi brings down this idea that it's semi-diagonal, and the Rambam seems to take that approach, and so they take this as Kodesh HaKadoshim, even though every single time you see a menorah pop up on the side of a shul, and in a dug-up synagogue, in a mosaic, and on the floor, and in a grotto, a nashua, whatever it is, and a coin, it's always rounded.
And the Arch of Titus.
Especially the Arch of Titus, especially that one. Because that one,
if they stole it,
right, they had it in their possession. Everybody knows that it went to Rome, and from there the question becomes what happened to the menorah. So I actually wrote a little bit about this when I was in college, and according to Mamzin, that's his name, Mamzin, a German historian, if I recall correctly, I think he said that it was either burnt up by the Goths, the Visigoths, Genseric, who, you know, attacked in the early 400s, or maybe it was transported over to Carthage. Either way, the point that we want to make is that the depiction on the Arch of Titus is that of a rounded menorah, and it would have to be the menorah that they stole, because that was the one that they were trumpeting. That was the whole point of it. They were trumpeting, we got the Jews' menorah, look at this beautiful thing. Now, can you imagine if it was actually a diagonal menorah that they had stolen from the base of Mikdash, they transported to Rome, they put it on display in what becomes the Vatican. Seriously, if I recall correctly, they put this up in a temple, and that became ultimately St. Peter's Basilica. But the long story short of this is that if they put up something that was diagonal, but then the sculptor has the audacity to not honor the actual item that's hanging three blocks down in the temple, and he makes it look rounded. Meanwhile, it's actually diagonal. That guy would get executed, I would think. I mean, how do you possibly play with the way the thing looks? If you have it in your possession, and everybody can go see it, and I presume a lot of people did, because it was available, and they put it on display publicly to shame the Jews, so that when the sculptor comes along and puts that on the arch, you know he's doing you know, something at least it's accurate for what the actual item is. It's an accurate portrayal of it. I mean, it's sad that he put it up there. I mean, because the whole thing is very sad. But that doesn't mean that he's false in his portrayal of it. He was showing us a rounded menorah, because that's what the menorahs were back then. At least that one was. You want to say that in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, there was one that was diagonal? That's what they want to argue. I don't know. I wasn't in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. But everything that we've ever seen, every menorah that we've ever seen dug up, has always been rounded. And so there's a split between Chabad and every other Jew on the planet as to how to depict a menorah come Hanukkah time. And whenever you see a diagonal one, my heart aches when I see it, because I don't think it's historically accurate at all. But they stick to their guns. We stick to our guns. And it's a very funny 8-day holiday where they light these big diagonal menorahs, you know, publicly. And at the Kotel, it's rounded. And in Central Park in New York, it's diagonal and all that. So Sandra Goldberg said that gold is so heavy, it would be quite, he didn't say it in these words, I'm kind of making him say it. It's an astounding thing if you would have a diagonal menorah, because that is a heavy element. And to make it out of gold would mean you really have to, I don't know why. I mean, that thing would normally just break off and fall down. If you're making it out of this very, very heavy element of gold, it just would not be able to stay against the gravity in a diagonal fashion. Whereas, he said, if you round it, now you've got some support going on, and it's not fighting gravity all the way. It's got some support. As you round it up or whatever, now it's able to, I guess it's like, you know, like, you know, I don't know. Hold, it just kind of falls and it puts its weight upon the rounding, but at least it's not this diagonal thing, which is very, very difficult to maintain, he said, because of the weight of gold. Take it or leave it, that's what he said, if I recall correctly. And I'm the kind of guy that likes to see what was dug up from 2,000 years ago. That really means something to me. What did you find? And you found everything rounded. So that kind of tells me something. And just as a very, very quick aside, in our local Jewish paper here in Cincy, American Israelite, ran an article about how they found yeast in 5,000-year-old potsherds, if you saw that article, and they're recreating beer in Israel from 5,000-year-old yeast particles. This is truly amazing. I mean, it's lost on me because I don't like beer, but if I could get my hands on that Hebrew, I would try to do that, and we would put that over here and see if people like 5,000-year-old recipes for brew, for beer. It's a fascinating thing. History is still among us in Israel, constantly finding stuff, always digging up stuff, digging up treasures in the land of Israel. It's truly amazing. We continue on. Are we there yet? Not sure. Okay. Body shields. We are in verse 16. I'll just read the English again. King Solomon made 200 body shields of malleable gold, of zahav shachut, malleable gold. Sheish miot zahav yaleh ala tzina ha'achas. 600 dinar of gold he would put into one body shield. As I said, it's pretty heavy, pretty impressive, and very expensive. Take a look at the footnote on 16. Body shields. The Hebrew word is tzina, or tzina. The actual accenting goes in the last syllable. The word is actually tzina. A body shield that encircles the person from three sides. And not the front? I mean, three sides. I'm a four-sided guy, right? I mean, back, side, front. Don't I need to be shielded all over, Mrs. Burlov? What do you say?
Maybe it's not in the back. Maybe it's the front and side, okay, because you're facing your enemy.
Right. But enemy...
Turn to flee, heaven help.
Right. Turning to flee, heaven help you. But, you know, if you've ever seen these movies, people are all over the place. Guys are in front of you, stabbing other guys. Guys are in back of you. And if they see a guy who's vulnerable and he's got his back exposed, well, they'll just slap a sword right in there and end it right there. So I would have thought that you need to be covered, you know, all over the place. But what do I know? Rashi says this is an encircling thing from three sides. All right? Maybe that is just the way things were. It was easy to get on. And maybe making a medieval-style bodysuit of four sides, maybe that was just a little bit much for the local seamstress.
Or maybe the one side was open for your...
For your sword?
Sword, yeah.
Okay. So maybe it was... Mrs. Brulov is suggesting that maybe you've got a back part protection, so you are covered on the back, covered on a side, covered in front, but you've got the other second side of your body, and there, if you have your sword, well, you're able to release it pretty quickly because there, the armor is not going. So that enables you to fight properly. You can take out your sword quickly and do what you got to do. So maybe that is the way to look at it. Certainly possible. We're trying to figure it out. This is the meaning of the pasuk in Tehillim. Now, I said some Tehillim last night for my wife, 36 to 40. But this is Psalm 5. Maybe Mrs. Brulov knows this off the cuff. As a body shield, katsina, with goodwill, you shall surround him. If I can find a quick Tehillim, I'm gonna. If not, not. But if I can find one, I'll just make a quick look. You got a Hebrew right there? Great. Thank you very much. Or it could be that Rashi himself is just quoting it. Maybe just take a look at Rashi. Katsina ripson teatarno. But I want to see the actual, I want to pronounce that last word correctly. So let me just see. Psalm 5:13. Thank you so much for this. And I see it's got some German, right? Kapital 27. From Victor Goldschmidt. Verlag in Basel, Rechtsnachfolge from Dr. Felix Kaufmann. Okay, here we go. 5:13. Kiatat tivarech tzadik Adonai, katsina ratzon tat renu. You will bless a righteous man, O God. Katsina ratzon tat renu. As a body shield with goodwill, you shall surround him. As a body shield, Ratzon Tat Renu, you will surround him with goodwill. Wow, how interesting. So this body shield is surrounding the person. Like that. And there's your word, katsina. Thank you. Good. So that's Rashi. Now, then the pasuk says, he made 200 of these body shields and 600 dinar of gold he would put into one of them. 600 dinar of gold he would put into one single body shield. Take a look and see the mathematics of this. 600 dinars. So says Rashi, six mana. 600 dinars equals six mana. So I guess maybe if a dinar is a penny, and you've got 100 pennies, then that equals up to one mana. But let's let him do the math. Six mana for a piece of gold. A piece of gold is known as a zahav. Excuse me. A piece of gold is a zahav. And a piece of gold is a dinar. And 100 dinar total, one mana. It takes 100 dinar to equal one mana. So for an American... thinking about it very simplistically, just think of it like I said, in terms of pennies. You've got one penny, and that penny is known as a dinar, and then you've got 100 such pennies, and that totals up to one mana, and you've got these six mana, so you've got 600 pennies. Exactly as the pasuk says, he calls it 600 dinar. Obviously, it's not worth a penny. We're talking about gold over here, and a dinar weighed a lot, and we're going to see it's an international, the Radak is going to tell us this. The Radak claims that a certain golden coin was universally adopted, and its weight was standardized. It was called Zahav, a gold piece. So everybody wanted to get their hands on Zahav, a gold piece. It was a valuable, valuable piece of money. it was not a worthless penny. Okay? In all events, he, Shlomo, took 600 dinar of gold, and he would put them, and that's 600 pieces of gold. That is 600 little pieces of gold. That's the equivalent. And he would put these 600 pieces of gold into one of these body shields, and he made 200 of them. So do the math. 600 little pieces of gold times 200 body shields. We're talking about 12, and then you've got four zeros following it. So it's like 120,000 little pieces of gold, right? Because, I mean, wow. 600 times 200, and you've got quite a bit of gold flying around over there. We continue with the footnotes on verse 16. Abar Benel reiterates that scripture is continuing with a description of Shlomo's wealth. Shields and body shields were generally made of iron. Shlomo's, however, since he possessed the necessary resources, were made of gold. And as I write in my little footnote, had to be a very heavy shield to have a shield made out of gold. I mean, that would have been a difficult thing to pick up if it was going to do its job of fending off against the sword. It is going to be one very, very heavy shield made out of gold. Amazing. Absolutely amazing. We continue on into verse. What are you looking for, Mrs. Brewer? You seem intent on finding something. What?
No, that's all right.
Okay. I'm continuing at verse 17. Pasuk Yud Zayin. See, even the art scroll has it rounded. Even the art scroll has a rounded depiction of a menorah. 17, Yudzayin, Ushlosh Meot Maginim Zahav Shachut. And 300 shields, Shlosh Meot Maginim, a magain, a shield, a defensive thing. Right, we say in Davri, Magain Avraham, Shem is the shield of Abraham. So over here, he made Shlosh Meot Maginim, he made 300 shields, Zahav Shachut, out of what they translate beaten gold. Shloshet manim zahav yaleh ala magen achas. Three mana, and that of course means 300 little pieces of gold. 300, or, well, a dinar. It says over here 300 dinar. 300, 300 little pieces of gold, right? Oh my. Three mana of gold he would put into one shield. Okay. Vayitneim HaMelech Beis Ya'ar HaLebanon. And the king placed them in the house of the forest of the Lebanon. Okay. 100 dinar equals one mana. So you've got 100 dinar. You've got 300 dinar. And therefore you've got three mana. And three mana of gold, a three mana of gold, he would put into one shield. Okay, because one mana, 100 dinar equals one mana. So he had three mana, which equals to 300 dinar of gold he put into one shield, and the king placed them in the house of the forest of Lebanon. Take a look at that and see. It's mostly going to be talking about the shield. The Mefarshim talk about the shield. Shields, maginim. They want to translate that. Maginim, what does the Abarbanel say? What does the Mitzvah say? A shield is carried by hand, and it's used to block enemy arrows. And so this is an all-gold shield, apparently. And it was made out of zahav shachut, beaten gold. Says Rashi, it is soft and easy to flatten out. The Mitzvah Sion says that the gold is stretched, just as wax can be stretched. See also Sefer HaShodoshim by the Radak. Anybody ever see how bakers make pastry? They stretch it out till it's paper thin. Now, I'm not going to necessarily make a connection between, you know, dough and gold, but over here we're told it is beaten gold and that it is stretched like wax can be stretched. Then Targum Yonason renders good gold. Rabbeinu Yonah Ibn Gana renders pure gold. So these are possible translations for the phrase Zahav Shachut, good gold, pure gold. soft and easy gold, stretchable gold, that kind of thing. So we're getting the idea.
And nobody's talking about the house of the forest of love.
And nobody seems to want to discuss that.
They probably don't know what it is.
Right. It could be, right. It could be, you know, I've always...
There was one house in the forest that was hidden or something.
And the king placed these shields in the house of the forest of Lebanon. Now, didn't he have some presence in Lebanon? Didn't we read earlier that the king did have a house of some sort? Am I wrong completely? I thought I came across that he maintained some sort of residence all the way up there in Lebanon. If I'm mistaken, let me know. But that would clearly be what they're talking about, what the author's talking about. What's it?
Kim gave him something,
and also he was. What else was he doing? He would go up there, I think, and he would check on the work, something like that. Okay, we continue, but nobody really wants to touch that. Okay, verse 18, Yurches, Vayasam Melech Kisei Shein Gadol. The king made an immense ivory throne. He made an anak, gadol. He made a very, very big ivory throne by tzapeo zahav mufaz. And he overlaid it with zahav mufaz. This is glittering gold. Previously, we were introduced to zahav shachut. Now we're hearing about zahav mufaz. This is glittering gold. Well, what does that mean? Take a look at the footnote. The throne, kisei shein, the throne of the kingdom. This is the king's throne, Rabag reminds us. And it was glittering gold. It was overlaid with zahav mufaz. Glittering gold, what does it mean? Hebrew zahav mufaz is how they point it over here. In the pasuk, it's actually mufaz, which sparkles like diamonds, says Rashi. Wow. The Radak interprets it as gold imported from a place named Paz. This explanation is quoted from Yerushalmi by Tysus in Yuma 44b. Okay. He suggests further, says the Radak, that this may be highly refined gold from the root Pei Zion Zion to strengthen, since gold is strengthened when the dross is removed, says Sefer HaShoreshim. The Rabag likewise explains this phrase as highly, Zahav Mufaz, highly refined gold, but he establishes the root as Pei Vav Zion, identical with Pei Vav Tzadi, to scatter. Before the gold was refined, it was broken up into small particles and scattered in the crucible to facilitate the refining process. The more the gold was refined, the more lustrous it became. Thus, the interpretation is very similar to Rashi's, says the Mitzvah Tzion. And we continue with a footnote. We find in the Gemara in Yuma 44b that there are various qualities of gold. There is Zahav Tov, good gold, a naturally pure mineral, pristine, from which nothing is lost during the smelting. There was also Zahav Sagur, closed gold, and that was so named because when it was traded, all of the gold exchanges were forced to close. Because when it was traded, when this closed gold was traded, all other gold exchanges were forced to close. Wow. There was Zahav Mufaz, a gold which shone like the diamonds. Also Zahav Ophir, gold mined in Ophir. And Zahav Paravayim, a reddish gold.
Rose gold.
Rose gold, whose color resembled that of the blood of oxen. That's pretty dark, I would think. Zahav Shachut. Okay, a gold that can be spun like threads. Either way, he's magnificently wealthy. He's making shields out of gold. He's making armor out of gold. He's going to have his throne made out of ivory, overlaid with glittering gold. Verse 19. What did we do? Yeah, okay. Number 19, your tests. Sheish ma'alos lakisei. There were six steps up to the throne. The Rosh Agol lakisei me'acharav. And the top of it, according to this translation, was circular from behind. Not going to be so entirely clear to the commentators how to understand this, but still, there are, everybody agrees there are six steps to the throne, and the top of the throne was circular, me'acharav, from behind, v'yados mizeh u'mizeh el makom ha'shavas. And there were arms on both sides by the place of the seat. There were arms on both sides by the place of the throne. Ushnayim arayos omdim eitzel hayados. And two lions are standing beside the arms. This is Brola, what do you got?
I'm thinking of like a collar chair where it's big. You know, and you, the old wing chair, but rounded,
mm-hmm.
where the back is rounded, and then you have the arms coming out, but forward. That's what I'm envisioning.
Okay. A collar chair.
Kind of.
Sure. That sounds right.
Wow. Good idea.
It must have been a magnificent thing. It got these. Presumably these are carved lions. And who else have you seen carved lions? Where do you see carved lions as you walk up steps? In the New York Public Library, on the main branch at like 40th Street, 41st Street to 42nd Street. It's this enormous structure. And you've got, if I'm not mistaken, you've got patience and fortitude, I think they call these, the lions, patience on one side, fortitude the other. The lions have names, and there's one on this side, one on that side, and you're walking up to gain knowledge. You're walking up to the palace of knowledge. Maybe it's based completely upon this verse over here in 1 Kings. At all events, let's go back to our pasuk over here in 1 Kings and see what there is to see. Take a look at the footnote on 19, 6 steps. Pasuk said, Sheish ma'alot, like he say, six steps up to the throne. Rashi in English, six steps by which to ascend to it. Steps given to the person so he can walk up. And the top of the throne was circular. That is the place of the king's seat. The place of the king's seat was circular. The seat seems to be circular. Right, we're going to hear from somebody else. let's keep it going. Me'acharav, what does that mean? Agol lakisei me'acharav. And they translate it circular, on top of the throne, circular from behind. So what does that mean, me'acharav, from behind? Quoting Rashi, the steps were to the front and to the width. To the back was the seat, a round place, higher than the throne. To the back was the seat, a round place higher than the throne itself. I'm not even sure I can picture this.
Yeah.
I got a throne, and then there's something circular in the back that's higher. From behind the throne. You got the circular thing. Wow.
And the same as the seat. That's my problem.
Yeah.
See, whereas I would say, okay, so it comes up here, and it's kind of circular here with arms coming out. That was my first envision.
Yeah, doesn't Rashi kind of contradict himself a little bit over?
Yeah.
I don't know, a little bit. The top of the throne was circular. That is the place of the king's seat. That's the top of the throne, the place of the king's seat. Then it says, the seat, a round place, higher than the throne. You got me. I guess I got to see it to believe it. We're going to continue that.
He considers where the seat is the throne, and then the back
mm-hmm.
that comes up higher.
And that's circular?
He's saying it's higher than the throne.
Okay.
And the seat is the throne. That's how I'm at.
Uh-huh. Well, you know,
okay.
Is it the case that this circular thing is in back of the throne?
So,
it's his back? It's for his back?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
He leans back out.
It's like a big wing chair. It's only rounded and circular.
I think someone's going to say that. So, yes, that's a possibility. Perhaps Rashi, I see. So here, over here, the rabbis themselves are a little bit befuddled. Maybe Rashi means that the backrest was rounded to fit the king's back, and that is possible because of the word mecharaf.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
The Abarbanel and Mitzurah are being quoted in the next paragraph. Others explain, Abarbanel and Mitzurah, that above the king's head was a circular dome. Supported from behind the throne. So you have something behind the throne that's supporting the circular thing on top of the throne. Above the king's head was a circular dome, and the king is sitting on the throne. Wow, this is not easy. And arms on both sides. Let's take a look at that. Yados, mizeh u'mizeh. Arms on both sides. It says, Rashi, arms on both sides on which to support his arms, like two gold rails from corner to corner, extending on the right and on the left. So you've got these very long areas to rest your arm, your elbows and your arms for the king, made out of gold rails from the right and from the left. And also the pasuk says, see it? And two lions standing beside the arms. Says Rashi, and two lions of gold. The entire plan of the throne is described in the Agadah of the book of Esther. See below verse 5, chapter 5, or maybe it's verse 20. See below verse 20. Okay. Whenever I see the letter V, I'm thinking, oh, that means chapter 5. Could it be that? See below chapter 5 and then 20? No way. I don't think there's any of
the first 20 here.
Well, let's just go see if they're doing anything at all. Anything else. Okay. Nope. Not relevant to us. So they really mean, see below verse 20. The entire plan of the throne is described in the Agada of Esther. Good. Pasuk 20, Chaf. Ushneim asar arayim omdim sham, and 12 lions stood there, al sheish hamalos mizeh u'mizeh, on the six steps, on one side and on the other. Again, 12 lions stood. Al shei shema los mizeh u'mizeh.
Okay. And these 12. In addition to the two lions.
Yeah.
Okay.
12 lions stood there on the six steps. Al shei shema los mizeh u'mizeh. On one side and on the other. So you got.
One lion on each step, on each side.
One lion on each step.
On each side.
On each side. Uh-huh. Well, back to back, if you will. What's that?
I don't know which way the lions are facing, but, you know, you've got steps. You've got a lion here, and then you've got a lion here, and a lion here, and a lion here, and up the steps.
Right. One on each side, that equals two per step.
Right.
Good. All right. It says the pasuk lo na'asachem l'chol mamlochos. This was not made for any other king. You don't see this going on by anybody else. I love that. Let's take a look at the footnotes of it. There's quite a bit of footnote over here. Mizeh u'mizeh. Let's just review that for a second. Al shei shema'alos mizeh u'mizeh. There are 12 lines on the six steps. Mizeh u'mizeh. on one side and on the other side. Says the Masuda, that is six on one side and six on the other, right? Six steps. You have six going up on the left. You got six going up on the right. One line per step all the way up. Six times two, 12 lines. The Malbim explains the symbolism of the throne as follows. Now we're going to get some pshat going on. Excuse me. The lions were the symbol of the tribe of Judah. Lion of Judah. Based on Yaakov's blessing in Genesis chapter 49, verse 9. There were 12 lions in all, signifying, and why? Signifying the 12 progenitors of Shlomo, from Shlomo onward, from Judah rather onward. Again, there were 12 lions in all, that's what we just heard, 12 lions stood there, signifying the 12 progenitors of Shlomo from Yehuda, Judah onward, and including Solomon, or you could say from Yaakov, one generation back to the father of Judah, and then you'll take it to King David, one generation, obviously, before Shlomo, Shlomo's father. So you've got, however you want to cut it, there are 12 progenitors from Shlomo, from Judah to Solomon, or you've got 12 progenitors from Jacob to David. Moreover, Shlomo's pool had 12 oxen and his throne 12 lions. Shlomo's pool had 12 oxen. His throne had 12 lions. These correspond to the Merkava, Ezekiel's vision of the divine chariot. You'll see that in Ezekiel chapter 1. I'm going to read that very soon on Shavuos. Nobody really understands it unless you are a Mekubal, and then you're not talking, and you're not sharing your knowledge. So those who know are not talking, and those who are talking don't really know. At all events, this is the Masa Merkava. This is seen in Ezekiel chapter 1. It's Ezekiel's vision of the divine chariot, where four beings are depicted as eagle, ox, a lion, and a man. The water of the pool is symbolic of the divine attribute of loving kindness. Right? The water of the pool, that reflects the idea of loving kindness. Whereas the throne that Shlomo sat on is symbolic of the divine attribute of justice. On the other hand, the ox appearing on the left in the vision of the Merkava symbolizes justice, whereas the lion appearing on the right symbolizes loving kindness. Wow, I never would have thought that, you know, a lion is going to be representing loving kindness, but you learn something new every day. Thus, each attribute softens its opposite, combining justice with kindness and kindness with justice. This is an incredibly long footnote. Take a look at it. It's like 2 pages. Take a look. But why leave it out? Abarbanel sees the throne as symbolic of the kingdom. The dome was symbolic of its having been bestowed upon Shlomo by God himself. The two lions standing on either side of the throne denote that the princes of the Torah, the sages, and the prophets shall reign supreme as lions. The two arms, one on each side of Shlomo's throne, bedecked in gold, the two arms signify that the judgment will always follow both the written and the oral Torah. He sees the 12 lions as symbols of the 12 tribes, corresponding to the two onyx stones of the ephod, on which the names of the 12 tribes were engraved, six opposite six. Sorry?
He's right, one on each side.
Okay. Sees the 12 lions as symbols of the 12 tribes, corresponding to the two onyx stones of the ephod. Wow, six opposite six. Beautiful. Esther Rabba states that the six lions signify the six heavens, 6 days of creation. That's what the six lions represent. Six heavens, 6 days of creation, and the six special precepts that the Torah imposes on a king. They are He shall not have many wives. He shall not have many horses. He shall not increase much gold and silver. You find all that in Deuteronomy chapter 17, verses 16 and 17. You shall not pervert justice. You shall not respect persons. You shall not accept a bribe. When Shlomo set foot on the first day of the throne, when Shlomo set foot on the first step of the throne, a call arose admonishing, he shall not have many wives. When he set foot on the first step of the throne, he was reminded of that. Wow. We're going to see later that he had a cheshbon. That's what many people do, as to why he didn't follow the Torah law on that. Alternatively, the six steps represent the six orders of the Mishnah. Zeraim, seeds. Moed, appointed seasons. Nashim, women. Nezikin, jurisprudence. Kachim, hallowed things. And Taharos, ritual purity. According to Midrash Abba Gurion, the throne was much more elaborate than Scripture alone indicates. This Midrash relates to us that there were six ways to ascend the throne, and each way had six steps, and on each step there were two lions. He would ascend by means of a mechanism. When the king would step down, the lions would extend their paws, one from each side. Biblical verses were engraved on their paws. He would turn right and read, you shall not respect persons in judgment. He would turn left and read, you shall not accept a bribe. And so on, all 12 laws were buried. And so on, all 12 lions were written similar verses. Each step was paved with precious stones, some white and some green and red and crystal. Date palms surrounded the throne, enwrapped in linen, and peacocks of ivory opposite the eagle's wings, and two marble pillars on the heads of the lions, and two hollow golden lions from either side of the throne, full of all kinds of perfume. Also, there were two chairs standing on both sides of the throne, one for God, the Chozer, and one for Nathan and Avi. Nathan the prophet, who will tell them what's going on. Oh, look at that. Midrash Panim Acherim. One for the high priest and one for the prefect. Again, there were two chairs standing on both sides of the throne, one for God the seer, one for Nathan the prophet. And the Midrash says one for the Kohen Gadol and one for the prefect. 70 chairs encircled the throne, one for the 70 elders. Wow. There's so much more to do. But we've reached that point where you've got to go back home and start baking cheesecake.
Or shaping collars.
Right. So I want to thank Mr. Brunner for coming out. Enjoy the rest of the week. Have a good Shabbos and a Chag Sameach. Enjoy the Shavuos. God willing, next week we should have leftover cheesecake and ice cream. Maybe we'll have a little party over here. Maybe that'll attract some people. Maybe not. But Sunday and Monday obviously are Shavuos. So all those shiurim, which normally are broadcast, won't be. But we will, God willing, come on back and continue doing First Kings. There's no reason why, at the conclusion of the Torah, a holiday of Shavuos, the giving of the Torah, that we should in any way falter. We will, God willing, continue giving the class on First Kings when we meet again next Tuesday night at 7:30. Wishing everybody a good Shabbos and a Chag Sameach, a very enjoyable Shavuos. It should be an edifying and uplifting one. And God willing, we'll see everybody very soon next week, Tuesday night at 7:30. Have a great one. Bye-bye now.